It was 50 years ago this month, in April 1945, that the Reader's Digest did something they'd never done before and they've never done since, namely to put the condensed version of a book in the front of the magazine rather than the back. That condensed book, of course, was Hayek's little classic, The Road to Serfdom. It's been published in March 10th, 1944, and despite being very much against the tide of its times, it enjoyed a phenomenal response. By the time it came out in Reader's Digest, it had already been reprinted 5 times, despite wartime paper shortages. It became the Book of the Month Club selection, and its critics were moved to write not just articles attacking it, but book-length attacks. Barbara Wooten's Freedom Under Planning, and in this country, Herman Feiner's Road to Reaction. Many people went to see Hayek to ask his advice on what to do. Among them were Harold Luno, who went on to head up the William Volcker Fund, Leonard Reed, who headed up FEE, of course, Baldy Harper, who was to go on to find IHS, and Anthony Fisher, who incorporated the IEA and many other free market non-profits around the world. Now, I'm not going to recommend 2 books in the tradition of Newt Gingrich and Joe Peden, but I am going to recommend to you 5 articles that Hayek wrote at that time and which outline the strategic advice that he would have given those people who turned to him at the time of the success of The Road to Serfdom. Those articles are The Historians and the Future of Europe, The Intellectuals and Socialism, An Opening Address to a Conference at Mont Pelerin, The Transmission of the Ideals of Economic Freedom, and The Dilemma of Specialization. Fortunately, they're all reprinted in his Studies in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics, which Chicago brought out in 1967. So what advice can we glean from Hayek? And let me paraphrase, let me cut all of that down to 7 sentences. Firstly, he said socialism had come into ascendancy in large part because of the failure of classical liberalism to present a relevant, living, and inspiring set of ideals. Secondly, he said there is scarcely, perhaps no, political ideal which does not carry with it a particular view of history. Thirdly, he said principled men and women of ideas have greater influence in the long run than practical men concerned with the minutiae of today's events. Fourthly, he said beware of special interests. Fifthly, he said do not go into politics, or you'll be trapped in a long drawn-out process, the outcome of which was probably determined long ago, and instead look for leverage in the worlds of ideas as a scholar, as an intellectual, or as an intellectual entrepreneur. Sixthly, he said, do not overlook the critical importance of the gatekeepers of ideas, the journalists, the clergymen, the novelists, the filmmakers, and so on, who decide what we hear, when we hear it, and how we hear it. And finally, he said, do not be guided by what is currently considered politically possible. And here let me quote 2 sentences from the end of The Intellectuals and Socialism. They're not the famous bit that you see often quoted and often on annual report covers and so on and so forth, where he talks about making the philosophic foundations of a free society once more a living intellectual issue, etc. But 2 sentences before that, about 5 sentences before the end of Intellectuals and Socialism, Hayek gives us his main lesson. He says, the main lesson which the true liberal must learn from the success of the socialists is that it was their courage to be utopian which gained them the support of the intellectuals and therefore an influence on public opinion which is daily making possible what only recently seemed utterly remote. Those who have concerned themselves exclusively with what seemed to be practicable in the existing state of opinion have constantly found that even this has rapidly become politically impossible as the result of a changes in the public opinion which they have done nothing to guide. So, Mr. Chairman, in looking to future intellectual challenge, the welfare state, let me take Hayek's 7 points as a basis, possibly for discussion later on. Next, make some general strategic points which could apply equally to welfare, to the environment, to regulation, to the many frontiers on which we fight. And finally, finish with some general thoughts on how this is influencing my approach in this particular area. Firstly, the funding of any intellectual challenge to welfare state. This is no problem. There's no problem of funds whatsoever. As we develop new programs to challenge the welfare state, we must totally reject the idea that such new programs, the consequences of any new program, must threaten some existing work. There are untapped sources out there. There are literally trillions of dollars about to change hands in a massive intergenerational wealth transfer. And finally, as we develop new market niches, new programs, so more funding will become available. Let me develop that last point, that as we develop new niches, more funding becomes available. When Father Sirico, who I'm sure pretty much everybody in this room has at least heard of and most of you have met, started the Acton Institute 5 years ago this spring, he did not take funding away from Heritage or ISI or IHS or Cato. In fact, he attracted new funding. If anything, he took funding away from the enemy. Take a small donor giving perhaps $5,000 a year to free market causes and $5,000 a year to church-related causes. That person is possibly somewhat concerned about what is going on in the church causes that they support. And here now, by transferring those dollars to supporting Father Sirico, those 5,000 they can transfer and support him are doing two things. It's satisfying their desire to do something about the churches, and it's satisfying their desire to pursue a free society. Take another example. Normally I would not speak about an individual donor, but he went public himself with this very story in Kim Dennis's Philanthropy Roundtable magazine. His name is Ned Galoon. He lives in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. I went to visit him some 3 or 4 years ago when I was president of IHS. And my goal at lunchtime was to get a $5,000 general contribution from him. I pitched him for the money, and I pretty much got his assent. Then I began to draw him out about what were his concerns. It turned out that he was giving $25,000 a year to Yale. And he was not at all happy with what was going on at Yale. He thought his money was being probably wasted, and almost he also had a suspicion it might even be working against his interests. So quick as a flash, I said, well, give me that money, and we'll set up a Yale fund at the Institute for Humane Studies targeted at good people at Yale. So that $25,000 that he then transferred from Yale to IHS, now for Ned Galoon, does two things. It satisfies his desire to advance the free market cause, and it satisfies his desire to help Yale. So there's no problem on funding of new programs. Donors respond to niche marketing, and they love it when the same dollar does two jobs. This is key to our strategy at the IEA, where we are expanding the number of units we have. We have a health and welfare unit. We've just added an environment unit. We're about to announce a regulatory studies unit, an education and training unit, and we've also added a student outreach unit. These units and the sub-programs that they generate already, our health and welfare unit, has several sub-programs. Our environment unit, less than 2 years old, has now begun working in science in a major way, attracting new money, attracting new people to our cause. Second, academia. In the so-called think tank world, we need to make much better and greater use of our existing networks of academics. Secondly, we need to expand our links deeper into the universities and quasi-university institutions, such as economics groups within major corporations. Thirdly, we need to be publishing not just people who are totally with us, who totally share our vision. When Arthur Seldon retired some years ago after 30 years as the editorial director of the IEA, he worked through a list of some 600 or 700 authors that he had published. And he worked out that approximately a third were not fully in our circles, but they shared part of our vision. And by encouraging them to write for the IEA, they had been brought in to share more. Fourthly, we need to educate our academic circles on our needs as publishers in the institutes so they can be alert for talent that we can harness. In particular, in Europe, and to some extent, this first point I'm about to make now really doesn't apply in this country, but in Europe in particular, we need more good public choice trained economists to help us unravel the whole welfare regulatory morass. And we also, on both sides of the Atlantic, need more good historians. I strongly urge you to stay on this afternoon for the second session, where you'll hear one of the most outstanding young historians in North America today, David Beto. David is the expert on welfare before the welfare state. What was welfare before the welfare state? As far as I'm aware, there's only David Beto on this side of the Atlantic and David Green on the other side of the Atlantic doing this work, and we need more young historians to fill this particular black hole. Thirdly, the market. We have to realize that we're operating in an international market. The war of ideas recognizes no national boundaries. The latest leftist $10 billion social work fraud that hits the US will unerringly find its way to Canada. Actually, it's probably come from Canada. Will unerringly find its way right around the world. We're in an international war of ideas, and it's an international market. To give you some idea, at the IEA, this year we will sell translation rights and reprint rights to our books in some 20 countries. We'll actually physically sell books in some 90 countries. Through Atlas, of course, our work continues to be cloned around the world. And some 50% of our authors this year will be based at universities outside the United Kingdom. Again, to illustrate this international point, Gordon Tullock recently came to lunch at my office. I think many people in this room will know Gordon. He is not a man who is prone to giving out compliments, shall we say. He has a very low propensity in that regard. But we, in 1976, had published a little book by him called The Vote Motive. It's gone through three English editions. But most important, we've sold the foreign rights on 11 different occasions to different countries. And that has led to multiple editions in countries around the world. And Gordon, of course, is an extraordinarily prolific scholar. He's the man who, I think, in one year when he was at Charlottesville in the economics department, single-handedly outpublished the whole of the political science department in political science journals. He has an extraordinarily wrong vita. And he turned to me and he said that this one little book, Vote Motive, was the single most influential thing he'd written in the whole of his life in terms of spreading understanding of public choice around the world. So we have to learn from each other's successes, and that is why these programs, such as these, are so important. Just to give a few more examples of programs that we've established in Europe recently that are essentially just a complete rip-off of programs we've observed over here. The work of PERC in Bozeman, Montana, has very much been the inspiration behind our new environment unit. The work of Cato has been very much the inspiration behind our new regulatory studies unit. The work of NIFTY, the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship in New York, has led to the establishment of a similar institution in England this past 14 months. The Institute for Children in Boston, Massachusetts, has led to some people in England getting together to champion a similar cause. And the work of IHS, of course, very much has influenced the work of IHS Europe and our own work in England now, reaching out to students. Fourth, and I hear that there is a problem, talent. There are three main theories of social change. For Marx, it was interests. For Mill, it was circumstances. For Hayek and Keynes, it was ideas. As I read in this literature, however, I keep coming back to one essential prerequisite for social change, namely talent. Money is not the constraint, it's talent. That's the real constraint. By talent, I mean people who share or are potentially capable of sharing our values and vision and have the ability or potential ability to advance a compatible mission in pretty much any walk of life. Certain career paths obviously are inherently more leveraged in the world of ideas, academia, journalism, churches, and so on, but we also need classical liberals in engineering, in architecture, in medicine, in all walks of life. Let me conclude, Mr. Chairman, by trying to pull together one or two of these thoughts. 10 years ago, I wrote an article for Reason. It was entitled, How to Move a Nation. Could a chicken farmer, namely Anthony Fisher, and two economists, namely Ralph Harris and Arthur Seldon, change British history? It was a profile of the IEA on its 30th anniversary. For that story, I interviewed at length Arthur Seldon, the IEA's then editorial director, who had so successfully developed the intellectual challenges to the labor unions, to end the dominance of the labor unions, to the nationalized industries, and to Keynesianism. Despite these three enormous successes to his credit, he lamented to me how impervious to intellectual challenge the whole education, health, and welfare areas had been And he probably published just as much in those areas as he had in the three where he'd been successful. And today in the UK, despite, and here I parody, despite a vicious Tory government slashing everything in sight for over 16 years, welfare spending has risen consistently in real terms. What is going on? Well, we have launched broad critiques and presented wide sweeping suggestions. The left has had a much more fragmented approach, much more like the market niche approach I was talking about earlier, with strong footholds in all parts of the welfare establishment. We recently published a wonderful little monograph by Deepak Lal entitled Minimum Wage, No Way to Help the Poor. And we might return to this topic every 5 years. But on the other side of the debate, just in England alone, there's a low pay unit with a budget of several hundred thousand dollars, a staff of half a dozen that does nothing but hammer consistently on this one issue. The same with the family. A friend of mine just finished running a series of 10 consultations on family policy and was telling me how, as he recruited people, he works for an independent institution that, although he shares our views, his institution does not necessarily, and how on topic after topic on family and the welfare state, he would find 10, 20, 30 groups wanting to maintain and advance the status quo and struggle desperately to find people who would share our views and who could come in and debate. I was reminded 2 days ago, I think, at one of the Heritage Resource Bank panels, we had the pollster Luntz, L-U-N-T-Z, from Virginia. And I jotted down a very interesting quote he made, and this is from his work as an opinion pollster. And he was talking about welfare reform. He said, "Pennies and dollars just won't do it. Economics is not enough in this area. You need to gain the moral imperative." And this reminded me of a TV program I saw recently in England, a series in England, where prominent individuals had been invited to become prime minister for a week. They've been trailed by BBC. They come on and they're interviewed by the cabinet secretary, and then they have their press secretary, and then you see them presenting their platforms to the people, and then they go out and try and test them against public opinion. And Patrick Minford, who some of you I'm sure know, one of Britain's leading free market economists, was invited to become prime minister in this TV program. And his platform was very much like the Association of Consumers and Taxpayers in New Zealand. Essentially, get the whole of the middle classes out of the tax and benefit system. Essentially, reduce their taxes so much that they can purchase their own education and welfare. Well, Gallup found a typical British middle class family for Patrick to go and explain this to after about halfway through the program. And he sat down with them and worked it all through with them, how it would hit them as mom, dad, little boy, little girl. And it turned out they were going to be, I think, £70 a week. That's about $110 a week, about $5,000 a year, better off. But no, they wouldn't buy it. Self-interest alone is not going to win the welfare debate for us. As Luntz said the other day, we need to gain the moral imperative. We know also, I think, to adopt this market niche approach I was talking about. I don't think a full frontal attack is ever going to work for us. We need to identify niche areas we can operate in with new units, new programs, new institutes. We need to identify the talent, as I said, the hardest job, and the resources will follow. We are, of course, outnumbered and outgunned in taking on the welfare establishment, but we were in such a situation, of course, 15, 16 years ago in the UK on labor unions and nationalization. In both these cases, success took well over a decade of intellectual challenging and well over a decade of implementation. 5,000 plus people at the 1978 Tory Party conference in England, I was probably one of only 10 or 20 people who firmly believed that we could privatize successfully large parts of the UK economy. It didn't happen overnight, but rather a bit at a time, and it's still going on with John Major tackling some of the harder privatizations that Mrs. Thatcher wouldn't touch, such as British Rail and the nuclear power plants, now coming to market. But what was just a glimmer in a few people's eyes, only as recently as 1978, only 17 or 18 years ago, is now a huge industry. This year, the City of London will earn several hundred, in fact, I think it's $800 million from privatization consultations and flotations outside the UK. So from an idea that was just a glimmer in 78, it's now an $800 million a year business, just on the consulting side, let alone the tens and tens, hundreds of billions of dollars of industries that have been privatized around the world. And I'm sure unions also, I won't go into details, but again, it was not a full frontal assault, it was a bit at a time. It'll be very tough, that these are huge vested interests we're tackling. Just to conclude, Mr. Chairman, with one story to illustrate perhaps how tough it'll be. About 6 weeks ago, we commissioned an author to just tackle one tiny little piece of this welfare debate. In this country, it's about a 10 billion piece of the jigsaw puzzle. In the UK, it's about a $2 billion piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And that is the whole issue of adoption and foster care. Why has adoption disappeared and been replaced, which is essentially a private solution to a particular problem, and been replaced by state-run, state-funded foster care? And we asked our author to address this issue, to explain why, under this last 16 years of conservative rule, although it's a trend that goes back a little before Mrs. Thatcher, have the numbers of adoptions dropped from 30,000 a year down to about 3,000 a year, and this huge budget grown up of about $2 billion. And we also asked him to address the question of, you know, shouldn't adoption be a valid childcare policy option? Well, news that we'd simply commissioned, the author hadn't even written the first sentence. News leaked that we commissioned this study. The Sunday Independent ran a headline, right-wingers want to force lone mothers to give their babies up. And then 2 days later, Today, which is a leftish-leaning tabloid newspaper, ran its lead editorial, and the headline was Baby Snatch Incorporated. And the editorial went on to ask, what do Herod, Hitler, and the general director of the IEA have in common? So it's going to be tough. There are vested interests out there that aren't going to let us get away with anything. But we have a goal, we have the strategies, the funds are no problem, I promise you, and we're working on the talent. Thank you.
Thank you, John. That last part was reminiscent of the old anti-Vietnam War slogan, Humphrey, Hitler, Key, they're all the same to me, which some of you, I'm sure, remember.